Welcome to Dhamma Hade, your Monday's favorite Dhamma discussion. So, along with Dhamma Hade, I have invited two well-known resource personnel who are well-known to you. And anyway, for the viewers who are with us for the first time, I would like to introduce both of them. First of all, I take privilege in introducing the most venerable Digale Mahinda Thero, who has come all the way from UK, and these days he's luckily for us, he's in Sri Lanka these days. And Bante is a reader. He's a reader in religions, philosophies and ethics at the Bath Spa University of UK. And while warmly welcoming Bante, I would also like to introduce Professor Ravi Koggalage, who's the former Deputy Vice Chancellor Academic of Sir John Kothalawala Defence University. He's a meditator, a meditation teacher with overseas experience. So, sir, we also warmly welcome you to Dhamma Hade. And today, viewers, I thought of, time to time we just ponder upon the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the path leading towards Nibbana. So we thought today we would take up this path, the Noble Eightfold Path, as a subject of discussion. First of all, I would invite the most venerable Digale Mahinda Thero to initiate this discussion. Over to you, Bante.
The Eightfold Path is usually called the Middle Path. And why it is called Middle Path is that I think in the Buddhist tradition, especially in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the discourse on the turning of the wheel, the Buddha specifically says that we should not have two extremes, you know, extreme of self-mortification, extreme of sensual indulgence. And what is interesting is that Buddha come to this Middle Path from his own experience, and he was searching for enlightenment, Buddhahood, but he was following other religious teachers at that time. And then one of the prominent method was that undergoing a lot of suffering, and the other one was undergoing a lot of comfort. And Buddha noticed that both forms, extreme asceticism and extreme form of sensual indulgence, both do not lead to the enlightenment. So his path is called Middle Path. So the avoiding the extreme. So that's the Eightfold Path, which has three major areas: morality, meditation, and wisdom. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about these eight aspects. How they are organized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Professor, is there anything you would like to add?
Yes, very correctly Bante has mentioned there are two extremes. You can't attain Nibbana, that is Kama Sukallikanu Yoga and Attakilamatanu Yoga. But at the same time, when we say middle path, sometimes I have heard people interpreting it different way. Like you can have little bit of that and little bit of this, two extremes. So that is kind of middle path, but it is not the thing I think Buddha has meant. Mm-hmm. Because middle path, then he described clearly.
Yeah.
I think we can go on to those steps later on, the Eightfold Path. So
yeah, I think the important point is that the Buddha's thought that undergoing, because I think he was reacting to the Indian teachers, and some of the Jain teachers, for example, thought that you suffer because of your bad karma.
Mm-hmm.
So only way to get rid of bad karma is that you have to undergo penances. You had to do certain form of ascetic practices.
Mm-hmm. So I remember Bante, because they used to sweep their way, whilst walking to get, to remove the creatures.
Creatures, yeah.
otherwise
bacteria.
That they would trample.
So the Buddha, you know, kind of there was a kind of philosophical understanding of these ascetic practices. Ascetic practices that only way to develop inside is you have to go through the pain. You know, you have to go through, then you have to go through the suffering. And Buddha himself went through it and noticed that he was getting weaker and weaker every day by doing it. And that's what gave him understanding that if your body is weak, then you cannot develop your mind, or you cannot have insight. So kind of what it gives is that healthy body, enlightenment occurs in a healthy body rather than a weaker body. So that's, I think, what we can learn from it, I think.
Yes, by going through that Duskara Kriya, I think 6 years of in this Attakilamatanu Yoga, he has proved that two things, as Bhante mentioned. One thing is if our body is weak, difficult to develop our mind. That is one point. Second one is just by giving unnecessary sufferings, you can't achieve this. So,
kind of delicate method.
Yes,
Buddha has a kind of delicate method that you need certain basic comfort like food, shelter. I think that's where I think it relates to these four requisites of the monk. You know, previous program we mentioned that the monks need four things. You know, kind of robes and the food and
place to live
and the medicine, and that's what I think moderation means in some ways.
Basic needs.
Kind of. So I think we kind of. I mean, you mentioned about the issue that people interpret this middle path, say that this foot of that and so on.
Yes.
That's actually not what it is. It's kind of say that.
Yeah. You know, especially the fifth precept. Sometimes.
yes.
They use the. I mean, as a joke, they use. But sometimes people
as
misunderstood.
An excuse also.
Yeah.
Probably.
It's okay, like moderate drinking or something like that.
Yeah, I think the drinking issue. It's also, I think. The point in Buddhism is basically it goes to the mind, training of the mind.
That's right.
So
exactly.
Because that's the heart of Buddhism, that you know that we have a mind and we think, and then our mind should be clear.
Yes.
And so from the Buddha's point of view, the drinking what happens is it distort the mind. It kind of makes it unstable.
Yeah.
And so I think Buddha did not necessarily think about the physical impact of the alcohol. Like, you know, today we talk about, when you think about alcohol, we talked about politics of alcohol. Yeah. Like, for example, the impact it has on the spouse, the children, the economy, and also the personal health. Yeah. And Buddha may have considered, but I think from this point of view more, kind of not having a stable mind was the most important one.
Yeah, because it's directly affecting your mind development.
That's right,
When we talk about the path.
So the question is whether you can have some alcohol. it's problematic.
Yes.
Because alcohol definitely change your mind setting. Mm. So.
But maybe, Bhante, just to interrupt you, I think certain drugs that we use for medicine contains alcohol. Maybe that much is enough.
That's right.
That is for as a medicine.
That's what I said. That's what I meant.
Yes.
If doctor prescribed you, then it's you can say okay, but you can't justify by drinking Vicodin.
I think in particularly in Asian culture, I think taking any form of liquor kind of rejected. You know, it's not part of the civilized life in some ways. So this
That's
is
right.
where I think the Asian values differ from the Western values. Yeah. In the Western countries, maybe the drinking is part of the civilized life in some ways. In part,
maybe because it's cold.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
And also maybe because of the grapes were, they were readily available in Palestine and in Israel and in that area. And because the wine was produced from grape, And so maybe came culturally, and also they were used for religious ceremonies, like in the church, you know, red wine, for example, as example of Jesus' blood, you know, so for example. So it's kind of, there's a kind of symbolism, you know, because you cannot use blood, but instead you use red wine. And so I think there's a little bit more validation there, and that may be the case, but even then, it doesn't mean that Christianity encouraged that people to be drunkard. You know, it's a different.
Yes.
It's a different point. You know, because you never get drunkard in the church, in for example.
That's why I'm very particular about this. When we say middle path, it should not misinterpret. It's okay to have a little bit of that
moderation.
It is not moderation. Because Buddha has clearly explained what middle path is, that's starting from the right view, the samadhi.
That's right,
So it is not telling about, like you can have this thing moderately or something like that.
No, I think it's alcohol one comes directly to the mind, I think.
That's right.
You know, because it's where, that's where it's disqualifies.
Yeah, you can directly experience it when you practice like samadhi bhavana. It's directly affecting. So, many people told me, those who used to drink, how it affect for this meditation, when they try meditation. So, then only they can notice how sensitive, for example, our mind to that.
This way, I think the Western practitioners find it problematic because a lot of people who come to Buddhism and people who write books and also practice Buddhism, they tend to have drinks on social occasions and perhaps in the dinner table. And then the experiences, you know, you may be able to question to how authentic the experiences are, because we, you know, like it's like the experiments done in 60s, you know, LSD and not so on, you know, in the Western countries, you know, kind of whether you could get religious experiences using drugs, you know, this is where I think the tricky area comes.
I think that leads me to another question, Bhante. That is, when you consider our topic today, the Noble Eightfold Path, it is categorized into prajna, sila, samadhi. And that is how the Buddha has categorized it, like prajna, sila, samadhi. But usually, when we refer it, we say sila, samadhi, prajna. And we try to practice sila and then go to samadhi and then prajna. But now, according to what you said, the Westerners who consume alcohol, but still they like to practice Buddhism, and that if that has become a barrier.
It's a barrier because the Westerners usually take Buddhism out of its context. You know, so they take only bhavana.
Exactly.
And not the sila part.
Exactly.
See, this is where, I think, where is the difference, is because in the Buddhist tradition, usually the sila is the foundation.
Exactly.
You know, it's like a foundation of a house.
Yeah.
And when the sila is there, there's opportunity that you can develop your mind and wisdom.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of logical analysis in the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. There's a debate going on. Like, first, it has to be prajna and then sila samadhi. As how it is described, I think, by the Buddha according to the categorization of the Noble Eightfold Path. Or is it sila, samadhi, prajna as we Asians take it? Sir, would you like to add something?
That's mainly because prajna part is the two factors, samadhi and sammasankappa.
Yeah. So which should come first?
The question is that, you know, the idea of samadhitti, that's usually in this eightfold path, that's the beginning point. And that means the kind of ditti means the vision.
Yeah.
And so I think the vision includes everything. Even selecting the precepts and all the other things. It has to be on the right vision. So that's kind of the broader framework, and within it, I think all the things come in, finding the right precepts or to understand the rationale behind the precepts. You should have the vision. So I think the question of where is the beginning of this path is a little bit hard to answer.
Yeah, it's like a cyclic thing or the interrelated.
Interrelated, and also it's a kind of maximizing it or refining that wisdom.
Yes.
Initial vision is what the enlightenment becomes. So
the wisdom also has different levels.
Different levels.
So when you start also, you need kind of wisdom to select what sila is, how to interpret
and also to do the right practice.
Yes.
And so kind of, well, maybe perhaps better to say like a discriminative thought or kind of like an introspective vision or something like that. You need it because if you don't believe that certain precepts are crucial, then you will not do it properly. You know, you'll be blind to the precepts rather than seeing its rational within it. So the wisdom side is very important part of it, even for other two parts, I think, for morality and also the concentration. But the target is also to going back to the higher form of vision.
Yes, when you start with certain level of wisdom and try to follow the path, your wisdom level also increase. Then you see further next level. So same things, even if we take sila, initially you see sila in a certain level, you can say just worldly level. Then when you develop your wisdom, you might see further something deep in that sila itself.
In Pali, something is called sila pratha paramasa. That means this sila means precept. Paramasa means kind of more like a kind of very detrimental attachment to the sila. Because you know, sometimes you know you are kind of paying attention to the form rather than paying attention to the meaning in it. So that when it become that kind of like a more like a routine and ritualized behavior, it becomes sila bhatta paramasa, and it becomes an obstacle for your improvement.
Yeah, we can see even you mentioned earlier that killing and when you walk, you clear the path, and like here very often we can see the being vegetarian.
Yeah.
As a kind of, it has taken as a kind of sila bhatta paramasa, extreme.
Yeah, that's the kind of beauty of the Buddha.
Yes.
You know, the Buddha did not go to that extreme.
That's right.
And also recognize, suppose that if we are absolute non-violent, then we cannot have even vegetables.
Yes, you can't even drink water.
That's right.
I remember somewhere mentioned, I think, this venerable...
And even breathing.
Yes, Venerable, I think Anuruddha, before he became Arahant, once mentioned, Buddha, I can't drink water.
Yeah, because they are...
Then he asked why, because there are living beings there. Then Buddha has asked, if I'm not mistaken, how do you get to know? Then he said, through psychic powers. Because he had psychic powers.
Yeah. He could see.
Yeah. Through those powers he can see.
Then
Buddha has advised, don't use psychic powers to see that, but just use this perahankada, what you call
strainer
and just drink water. Don't go into that extreme.
That's right. That goes to the monks, you know, the eight articles, you know, Attapirikara. You know, Attapirikara, one of the items.
It's
a strainer.
Clothes
to use for water. Yeah. So this is the one way of kind of responding to the criticism that, you know, we are non-violent, but we don't want to be obsessed with that principle because we don't want to make our life miserable.
There I see it's a kind of wisdom you have to use. Not to go to extremes in a way where you can't even live.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, without drinking water or something like
just
that.
And breathing.
Yes.
And also vegetables.
Yeah, even if you eat vegetables, to prepare vegetables, how many?
Lots of pesticides and insecticides have been used.
Yeah, and apart from it, and you see that vegetables also grow.
Yes.
You know, you see that they absorb water, and you see that day by day grow. That means they have life.
Yeah.
And they are not very different from us in some ways, because at least they have one aspect that they grow. Mm. You know, they may not have eyes, but you never know. But they, you know, the vegetables grow. So if you go to that extreme, then you will not have any food. And so the Buddha was kind of, and also agriculture, farming.
Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, the
you can't do farming. I mean, if you go to extreme,
yeah.
How you dig a hole or something like that. Without, you know, affecting those small animals.
And this is related to our question about the Eightfold Path, because agriculture in the Buddhist society is saying that right livelihood, basically agriculture, being a farmer and so on, so it's connected to it. Now, Buddha wanted to say that, Buddha did not say that we should not plow.
Mm.
You know, so the Buddha did not prohibit people plowing. So a farmer has to plow, and that inevitably involves taking lives or forms of lives. You know, you cut the grass and you cut the soil and you cut, you know, and by accident you cut the worms. And then Buddhist idea is say actually by doing that, the farmer doesn't accumulate bad karma because the intention is not to kill those.
Yeah.
So this initial wisdom level to start the path, I think you have to define those things, what level of sila I need in order to progress in this path. So when you develop your wisdom little by little, you'll understand more deeper levels.
Yeah. Am I correct to say that the five precepts are the basics for the
meditation? Yes, Bhante, even you say five precepts, how to interpret that? Now, we are taking, for example, this first precept, killing.
Yes.
And so, it has gone up to a vegetarian, be a vegetarian level.
Latest is veganism, and being vegan.
Veganism.
Yeah. Not even consuming milk.
Yes.
Or eggs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Westerners, there are people,
yeah.
Vegans.
Yes.
They even in don't Sri Lanka, it's very popular now.
I think those trends we should welcome.
Yes.
Because when people want to be very conscious about what they eat, I think that's we should encourage them to do that.
And I think the Buddha praised them. Like,
it's okay to do, but it is not compulsory.
Not compulsory.
Yeah.
And also we should not use as a yardstick to blame others.
Yes.
That's the kind of the danger.
Yeah.
You know,
so being a vegetarian, if you blame someone who is eating fish or meat, then you are getting angry.
Yeah.
And the desha mula sit, you know.
Yeah.
So you are doing akusal.
That's right, yeah.
So it's okay to be a vegetarian.
Yes.
For example, I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah,
but I'm not, you know, blaming anyone who is eating fish or meat. That's their choice.
Yes.
So.
And there are also that it's called panatipata veramani, that means kind of abstaining from taking life, you know, kind of living beings. That what means that here the precept is interpreted that we should not intentionally take certain organisms or deprive them life. And now with regard to meat eating, there's a question about to what extent your intention is carried over to it too. You know, because like for example, meat and eat was not prohibited for Buddhist monks because the rule was they should accept whatever is given to them.
Yeah.
So the responsibility lies with the lay person, not with the monk.
Yes.
So
not to offer if they don't want.
Yeah, that's right. So the layperson should actually protect the monk, not offering meat. But if the layperson offers the meat, then monks is obligated to accept it because that person, the monk, has to accept what they were given by the layperson. So that's kind of very interesting phenomenon there. So it's kind of not necessarily saying that eating meat or we should not eat meat or we should be completely vegetarian. There's more complex things about these relationships, you know, with various monastic community and lay community.
Yeah, so coming back to our topic, we'll start from the samadhi.
Yeah, I think it's better to start with this morality part because that's where I think the training is there included, basically training your body.
Okay.
And I think that's very much important for meditation, you know, both your body. I mean the killing is basically, you know, taking lives is basically a, you know, kind of thing that you do with your body. And then, or if you lie, or if you false speech, is misusing your mouth. So those things are included, like sammavacha, for example. In that precept, you know, sammavacha means that you use right speech. That means you, you're supposed to use the proper words and you know, dear words or words that is pleasant to the other person.
Yes, samvaca and sammakammanta are the first. In sila part, there are three parts: sammavacha, sammakammanta, and sammāajīva.
Yeah.
So the first two, sammadhitti and samma sankappa, comes under prajna category. Then sila category, sammavacha, sammakammanta, sammāajīva. So they are referring to, as Bhante mentioned, our bodily actions and verbal, whatever you say.
I think it's better to kind of explain those words. Samma vacha, vacha means speech.
Yes.
And ajiva means livelihood.
Livelihood.
Yeah.
Bhante has mentioned this livelihood. There are five wrong you should abstain from five ajivas.
Kammanta, I think those three words, like, important part is those three, I think. You know, samma kammanta, samma ajiva, samma
vayama.
That's meditation part, no?
Vayama comes into samadhi part.
Samadhi part.
Samma vacha, samma kammanta, samma ajiva.
Ajiva means livelihood.
Livelihood.
And that, why those three are, I think we have to stop it, you know. I think we were about the importance of sila. Samma vacha, samma kammanta, samma ajiva. So samma vacha means right speech, and samma ajiva means right livelihood, and samma kammanta means right actions.
Yes.
Yeah. So these three are the kind of governs what we take to be the five precepts. Also, they are very much part of it, I think. Maybe we can discuss each of them, you know, how they are valuable.
Yes. Samma vacha, of course, in our the five precepts or eight precepts, we have four categories we can avoid, like lying,
slandering, harsh speech,
And
false speech.
And
false speech.
Yes.
Yes. So if you abstain from those four, then whatever you talk becomes under sammavacha.
Sammavacha.
Because they are not harming anyone or yourself.
That's right, yeah.
Yes.
So there are two sides. We have always considered your own welfare and other person's own welfare.
That's right.
So here basically training your mouth.
Yes.
So the Buddhism is very much concerned about it. Mm. It's an important door of exposing yourself to the world.
Mm.
So it involves also not... sometimes, you know, we... in our day-to-day, we have a lot of chats, meaningful chats.
Yes.
And now Buddhism seems to question it. That's why I think it become very important, the silence when you're in the meditation, for example.
Yes.
So that's...
Yeah, when you take a practical situation, when you practice meditation, you can feel, you know, you can experience. If you talk before sit for the meditation, it's very hard to keep your mind at one point. So that's why many places in meditation centers, sometimes they call this in foreign countries noble silence.
Yeah,
so
noble
silence also kind of noble thing, because it's helping you to develop your mind, especially for samadhi.
Yeah, it prevents distraction.
That's right. Because to talk something before you express even one word, there may be thousands of thoughts behind that. So when you try to meditate, those thoughts come in. So disturbing you.
Especially when you talk, you always tell a story, or you talk about something, or you criticize someone, and these are always become important part of your unconscious thinking.
Yes.
And then later on, probably when you try to still your mind, they come up strongly.
So that's why I mentioned the initial wisdom to see if I talk, it is disturbing me for my progress in the path. For example, this case, developing samadhi. So I have to, you know, if possible, be keep silence all the time during this meditation retreat or somewhere. So if you, you know, control your speech, very easily you can develop your samadhi. So that's why it's directly affecting.
And also it's
mind.
Very valuable, this the idea of samavacha. We are talking about Eightfold Path. So I mean, if you think about contemporary society in Sri Lanka, what is missing for us is actually samavacha.
That's right.
So, you know, because you see that, I mean, we don't want to point out people's names, but if you think about the election.
But our culture, we used to talk unnecessary, lot of.
And especially the election, as Dante said.
In the elections, people use very rough language. And and also untrue language, and abusive language.
So
the samavacha actually preventing all of that. And also, if you think about the young people when they talk, and sometimes they tell about 10 words, and out of that 10 words, about five of those things use the word machang, you know, the kind of empty word. And fills in, and then the lot of noise, you know, people like to make a lot of noise when they talk, which is unnecessary, because you can tell that other person, you know, really, I mean this. But we add a lot of words, and all of these come under samavacha, I think, because not only using abusive language, but using the few words meaningfully rather than polluting the environment, because more noise we make, we disturb others. If they may not be meditators, but actually we disturb them because they distract them. So this is part, probably the importance of that, I think.
That's right. There's kind of story that one Buddha's time, one king went to see him, I think King Kosala or someone, and notice it's very silent, so he asked from the others, how can so many monks live in there? You said about 500 monks, but I can't hear
anyone.
Yeah, and he got scared. But
so this seems to be the heart of Buddhism.
Yes,
kind of
exactly. I think I would like to add something. Once I went to India, I would not name what exactly the place is, but it was a temple, of course not a Buddhist temple, and it was surprisingly very, very noisy. And a friend of mine who was an Indian, he said, like, when he came to Anuradhapura and it was Poya, there were lots of people who came to Anuradhapura, but he said still it was so surprising that they were all quiet at the Rohan Valley Sehmalua. And as Bhante correctly said, I really noticed the difference. So that is the heart of Buddhism, I suppose.
Yeah, and also kind of the practical way of translating this Eightfold Path into day-to-day life, because speech is the one that we use quite often. So we have to bring the meditative part into it. Like, for example, mindful speech. That's sammasat, you know, sammavacha, mindful speech, that you mind your what you speak about. You know, you use minimum words and meaningful words, and also you don't make a lot of noise. And you just tell the people what you want to say, and then be quiet. And that's actually could be one way of interpreting this sammavacha for day-to-day life, you know, how we can be useful for this way of life.
So these three sections, sila, samadhi, panya, or panya, sila, samadhi, whatever, these three are interrelated. So initially, you start with a certain level of maybe all three, like any of us has certain level, but we need to develop. So when developing, also these three helping each other. Because sometimes I heard, like, even you, for example, before starting your meditation, you can talk about lot of sila, but for example, when you try samadhi, then you realize the importance of sila. See, if I talk much, I can't gain samadhi. So then the wisdom tells you, okay, this is the necessity of, you know, controlling your word speech, because it's helping you to develop your samadhi. But, you know, before practicing any samadhi, sometimes I heard from others who just talk about these things without trying it, they can argue a lot about sila. They may argue, without sila, how can you have samadhi or something? But, you know, when you really practicing, only you notice the importance of sila, and also use your wisdom to see it. Now we are keeping sila not because someone is telling you. You know the real necessity of that.
Yeah, and also
how it is suffering.
When we think about the sila, from the Buddhist point of view, it's more like a voluntary commitment. It's say that I promise, or I take this vow, or I agree to myself that I'm going to do like this. So it's not like say that I do it because of I fear the Buddha or something like that. I'd say that I believe that, you know, good speech is good. It's good for me, so I do it. You know, kind of, there's kind of voluntary part of it in the Buddhist tradition. So, and also the beauty thing is that when you talk about the Eightfold Path, I think these things like speech, for example, add another dimension to the Buddhist culture, which is called the virtues, you know, kind of civilized Buddhist or civilized behavior comes to Buddhist life with right speech, you know, because when you use the beautiful speech, it makes your life pleasant and it displays your Buddhist qualities.
Yes.
Yes, so. Yes, Professor, is there anything that you would like to... Yes,
I'm more into this practical experience. Yeah. So, one thing, as earlier I mentioned, that the people may argue about sila. You must have sila first to have samadhi. But I have practical experience of thousands of people, those who practice meditation. If you try your samadhi, if you put an effort and develop your samadhi, say up to half an hour or so, then it helps you to keep your sila. Otherwise, if you try, okay, first I must have, you know, five precepts, you know, completely morality and then go and practice meditation, you'll never do that.
Yeah, you'll never do that, of course.
Yes.
They go hand in hand.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when you practice your samadhi
mm-hmm.
as well, then it will give you kind of a, what do you call and the self confidence mm-hmm. that to stop wrong doings.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, you know it is wrong, still you can't stop.
Yeah.
But when you practice your samadhi, it will build up your self-confidence as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that's why I say you start with certain wisdom level, you have certain level of sila, then practice samadhi. Then when you develop your samadhi, again your wisdom level go up and also sila, level of sila go up, and then you start with a bit higher level of wisdom. So they are helping mm-hmm. each other, mm-hmm. these three.
Connected.
So if you say you have to complete sila first and then go to samadhi, I think it's misunderstanding.
And also we have to think about these eight aspects. That's kind of intellectual way of presenting them, yeah? Mm-hmm. Kind of scholastic way of presenting them. Even the structure, prajna, sila samadhi, or sila samadhi prajna, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like a way of classification.
Mm-hmm.
But really you see that even this speech part, there is a meditative part of it. Like, you mindfully discipline your speech, and then the meditation is automatically there. So they're not kind of completely separate.
Yes. So that's more into your sati
part, I think, the
mindfulness.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And then it gives you wisdom, according to Buddhism, yeah?
That's right.
When the mind is concentrated, then wisdom arises, yeah?
Yes.
So there's a link with all three.
Mm.
So there's a link in all three, and as Bhante and Professor correctly said, that they go in hand, because as usual, what we try to do is, as Professor said, since we have been maybe taught many times that it is from the morality itself, then only we have to go towards the steps of samadhi and prajna. But no, as Professor correctly said, if you just wait to fulfill the sila aspect, do you know how much more that you have to do? Or we just don't know the limit of it. So I think it is wise to start then and there, wise to move on to the samadhi then and there.
So, yes. My advice is anyone to come and try, mm-hmm. practice meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So it will help you to develop your sila.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wait until you develop your sila and then practice meditation, it will never happen.
Yeah, for an example, if we consider from the Buddha's time, Angulimala, or if we consider Alavaka, or let's say Ambapali, because they were not ones who practiced sila and they came into the path.
Yeah, there are so many examples.
Yeah.
That's why you need kind of wisdom.
Wisdom, exactly.
to judge those, realize.
Yes. Bhante, we have 5 minutes and I would like to give you around 1 to 2 minutes to maybe summarize or just add a conclusion to our discussion today.
And I think what I see is the most important aspect of Eightfold Path is that it gives you it has several levels. On the very basic level, it provides someone a toolkit
mm-hmm.
to discipline oneself,
mm-hmm.
and then in a little bit advanced level, for that same person can develop the more concentrated mental framework,
mm-hmm.
and then there's opportunity to develop wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So that in that way, I think it's kind of, it looks like a very wholesome diet.
Mm-hmm. So, you can conclude, summarize.
Yes, my message is one thing. Don't wait until you complete your sila and practice.
You don't know when
meditation.
You complete or how much you have to do.
So try your meditation.
Okay.
So it will help you to develop all 8 factors. In different levels, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Like you start with worldly level, then when you get the other one, supramundane level, samadhi, only you'll complete your eightfold path in supramundane level. But you can start with worldly level, whatever you know. So it depends on your level of wisdom.
Sure.
And don't blindly believe, you know, when you hear something, don't do that without sila, you can practice meditation or something like that. But you try yourself and see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the, I think, important message.
Yeah, so that's the message that has been given by Professor Ravi Kogel again. And I intend to thank both the most venerable Digale Mahendra Thero as well as Professor Ravi Kogelage for sharing or disseminating the Dhamma knowledge among our viewers, with our viewers. So thank you so much. And thank you, viewers, for watching our program. And I hope and I wish that you would start practicing now. If you have any questions regarding our discussion, please write to the producer, the Mahadeya, the Buddhist TV, Sri Sambodhi Vihara, R.G. Senanayaka Mavata, Colombo 7. And other than that, Professor has his own question answer forum as well. So would you like to give them your email address?
Yes, you can email me any questions to the email address koggalage@yahoo.com, koggalage@yahoo.com. And also we have regular sessions if anyone wish to attend, every Saturday morning at Subhadra Rame from 8:30 onwards. Subhadra Rame Nugegude.
Okay,
yes.
So having delivered that message, we intend to put a comma to our program. So let us meet the next Monday with yet another fruitful program. Thank you so much. May the most noble triple gem bless you. Next time we'll go on with the questions.
Yes.
Yeah.
This topic also we could have talked more, but that we did. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Are we going to do it right now?